because of sovereignty, because of indigenous sovereignty, which was another issue that he was focused on. So he was really ahead of the curve on a lot of issues and very relevant discussions to us today. So the issue today that we're going to be talking about in this panel is about federalism, regionalism, and equalization. And this is really of special importance to us at the Institute because we have a center of excellence on the Canadian Federation, which both Olivia and Kyle have written for. And again, Tom was part of integrating those subjects, anchoring those subjects for 40 years at the Institute as one of our central areas of focus. Fiscal federalism, equalization, internal trade, spending power, the formal mechanisms of the Federation. These might seem like kind of dull issues to the average person, but they're actually fundamental to our social safety net, our national sovereignty, a wealth of issues that are very important to the country. But for some strange reason, and I know this has been acknowledged, there are very few people who study this. And I think someone joked that there are about four people who really know about equalization, and it's not a joke. there are very few people who do. But I'd like to introduce three people who do understand these things, who are going to talk about Tom and his impact on these subjects. So the Honorable Bob Ray, currently the visitor of Massey College, which Bob sounds like a Nancy Drew title, a distinguished fellow of the Monk School at the University of Toronto, a Matthews Fellow in Public Policy at Queen's University. He served as the Ambassador and Permanent Representative of Canada to the United Nations from 2020 to 2025, and was elected to federal and provincial parliaments 11 times between 1978 and 2013, and of course, Premier of Ontario from 1990 to 1995. Kyle Hanneman is Director of the Institute of Intergovernmental Relations and Associate Professor of Political Studies here at Queen's. He holds a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a BA from St. Thomas University, and was previously a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto's Institute on Municipal Finance and Governance. And Olivier Jacques is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the School of Public Health at the Université de Montréal. He received his PhD from the Department of Political Science at McGill University and has been the Skelton Clark postdoctoral fellow at Queen's University. That is a lot of bio information, and there's more that you can read in the program. And again, just to remind you, each of the panelists has been asked to speak to two questions. One, what was it about Tom and his work that made him such a prominent contributor to policy debates? And two, does his approach to public policy in the Federation remain relevant today? So I'm going to start with the Honorable Bob Ray.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jen. It's great to be here and wonderful to have a chance, thanks to Via Rail. And you have to be a really committed believer in public infrastructure to rely heavily on Via Rail for your travel. So I got here a little late for this morning, but I got picked up with a number of people at lunchtime to tell me what's going on. I was delighted to be asked, and also to, it allowed me to spend a little time thinking about Tom, because my experience with Tom goes back, as does my own experience with myself, goes back a long way. I first met Tom when I had just been elected to the House of Commons in 1978, and I was appointed as the finance critic for the New Democratic Party, which some people would consider to be a contradiction in terms, but I did my best. This was a moment in time when interest rates were very high, inflation was high, and interest rates were even higher. And it was a bone of contention and a subject of some controversy politically. I made myself unpopular with the Bowie family by referring to Jerry Bowie as Bowie the 14th. People did not like that. But I later, when I saw him once in Ottawa, he crossed the street and he shook his head. He reached out and he says, "Mr. Ray." I said, "Yes." He says, "It's Bowie the 14th." So you had to know Jerry Bowie to know what a wonderful man he was and how truly approachable and very even fair-minded, if I might say, not to say generous, to cross the street to say hello to a young punk who was trying to be smart. But Tom Kershen was a conservative candidate in the election in 1979 for the Clark government, for the Clark candidacy, and he ran in London. And in the course of which he came to Parliament Hill to give a presentation on basically the situation involving interest rates and, you know, what was happening. And after the discussion, which was quite heated, he said, and he was taking a lot of heat as a conservative because he was basically defending what it was the Bank of Canada felt it had to do. And he was saying, well, what choice do they have? The fiscal policies don't make any sense, so he's got to work hard on the monetary side. And I was chatting with him, and I said, you know, Tom, you're going to have a hard time knocking on doors with defending high interest rates. And he said, I don't care. It's the right thing. I'm doing the right thing. If you know anybody who remembered Tom would know, he was taken aback, saying, I don't care if it's unpopular. It happens to be the right thing. And I thought about it, and in all of my subsequent dealings with him, which have been extensive, it was the same spirit that came out in every moment of conversation. He was not interested in what was politically correct or woke or popular. He was much more interested in telling the truth about where things really were at and what it really meant. And I quickly learned that there was a truly eclectic way that his mind worked. And in all of my subsequent conversations with him, and we had many, and arguments, and we had many, he was always incredibly constructive in how he responded and how he insisted, and he would say to me, well, okay, prove that I'm wrong. Do your homework. So we once had a debate about this question of the situation of Ontario and the Federation. I gave a paper at Queen's University, and it was a paper, actually, because it had been prepared by the Department of the Ministry of Finance in Queen's Park, because they wanted to make a point, and they were constructing an argument as to why Ontario had been unfairly treated by virtue of the fact that when it came time for the federal government to cut back on the Canada Pension Plan, they decided they would cut back specifically on Ontario and British Columbia, so we were short of money as a result, or partly as a result. And it was also about other ways of estimating accounting and other ways of doing the national accounts, which by virtue of having become premier at a time when the province was deep in the hole, we had to do. We had to really explain and get at it. Tom admitted to me when he was making an argument, which he made subsequently in one of his books about how the Federation really works, the situation of Ontario and Ontario as a state, that he had not read that one particular article. So when I told him about it, he said, oh my God, I mean, I didn't refer to that, and it's a Queen's publication. I said, yep. He quickly read it, wrote me back and said, if I had to write the paper again, this is what I would have said. And I thought to me that was a sign of ultimate humility on his part and just general decency, which is what he had. The last engagement that I had with him, really a real good discussion, was with Hugh. And we were talking about Tom's book about the indigenous, his indigeneity and his really embracing it a little later in life, and then saying there's things I want to talk about why this is important and why we need to look at the governance situation involving Indigenous people that way. And I thought that was, again, reading that last, one of his final real efforts at defining the nature of the Federation. And what, again, was interesting about that, what's interesting about that book and about that argument is that he was not falling into any orthodoxy whatsoever. he was not falling into an easy indigenous narrative. He was not falling into an easy, you know, traditional federation argument. He was not particularly overwhelmed by the logic of all of the Supreme Court decisions, by which time there had been a great many, redefining the nature of indigenous rights and indigenous place in the federation. But he was dealing with all of them. And then he was coming at it from a purely personal perspective and saying, here's some things I think should be done. I understand Kevin Lynch had some things to say about analysis and suggestions for policy. Tom's suggestions for policy were not particularly practical and would not necessarily have been adopted by any one particular group. That's not the point. The point is he was trying to get everybody to think in a fresh way about how you could, in fact, increase the power and the authority and the sovereignty of First Nations in a context that was difficult to make work. And I think that's you know, I will always think of Tom as being iconoclastic, brilliantly researched, with one exception. But even that's just, I'm only saying that in a joking way, not in a serious way. But really determined to go from the lab to the patient as quickly as possible. And he never got stuck in the lab, and he wasn't going to go to see the patient unless he had done his homework, unless he thought he knew what some of the practical problems would be and how they could be solved. I'll make one final point. Tom's success as an academic is remarkable for this reason, the reasons I just gave. Too often in academia, as somebody who visits academia for quite a lot, we recognize people for the level of detail or for them having spent their entire career studying one subject and only doing that subject. We often don't reward people who have a wide scope and a wide range and are preoccupied with communicating with government and public communication. When I became premier in 1990, I asked people about who are the economists who are actually comprehensible to non-economists, able to engage effectively with governments about what public policies make sense. And it was a very small list when I asked the Department of Finance for who do you rely on. It was a very small list. And at the top of the list was Tom Crushane. And they immediately said to me, Premier, I hope you don't mind that Mr. Crushane is... I said, I don't mind at all. I do not mind at all. He's a brilliant guy. I don't always agree with him, but we would be unwise to be putting things forward without talking to him. And that's my feeling all the way through. So I really salute Tom's memory. He has a powerful legacy, and I wish he had more imitators. And I encourage all of you who are here as students, you could do a lot worse than imitate Tom Crushane, because he was a magnificent scholar. He was a great thinker. He was a humble man. He loved his students. He loved teaching. He loved engaging with everybody and anybody. And in that real sense, he was a marvelous public educator in every sense of the word. And that is a profound legacy for someone to have. Thank you for this opportunity.
Fell from the stars.
Hanneman is director of the Institute of Intergovernmental Relations and associate professor of political studies here at Queen's. He holds a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a BA from St. Thomas University, and was previously a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto's Institute on Municipal Finance and Governance.
All right. Okay, so we've been given two questions. Okay, so the first one was, what was it about Tom and his work that made him an effective contributor to policy debates? And the second one was, does his approach to public policy in the Federation remain relevant today? So I'll do my best to answer those questions. But before I do, I'm going to address another one. And that is, what was Tom's approach to the study of public policy and federalism? So My presentation is actually going to sound a little bit like Robin's, I think. Robin even stole my joke. I was going to say that I approached this with humility. Tom published faster than the speed I read, or at least the speed I can comprehend. But I'll give it a shot. Okay. So the first question, what was Tom's approach? So I think Tom's broad objective, and one that permeates almost all his work, was trying to figure out how to align Canadian federalism with the economic needs and challenges of Canadians. He liked to work from first principles, and the most enduring and foundational principle, though I may suggest in a little bit that there is an even a more general principle, but this one's been commented on today, was his mark of populism. So he was a firm believer in market forces, in individualism, but also a welfare state, particularly one that was designed to help Canadians thrive in that market economy. He was a keen observer of economic trends and their implications for workers and the types of supports they would need. And two trends that really stood out for Tom, they created a backdrop for much of his work, was the economic integration of the global as well as the North American economies and the emergence of the information economy. In A State of Minds and other publications, he argued that the best way for government to support Canadians in this economic context was a human capital approach, investing in the skills and education they would need to thrive and cope in a new economy. He also argued that the distinction between good economic and social policy had all but vanished. That was good for social Canada, or a human capital approach was good for the economy as well. Now, there's nothing particularly unusual about that point of view, particularly at that time. But Tom's, I think, his principal contribution lied in trying to reconcile this human capital agenda with Canadian realities, including our federal structures and processes. Tom, it's been said already here today, that he believed in a decentralized federation in which provinces would take primary responsibility for social programs and their funding. He thought this was the system most compatible with Canada's political, cultural diversity. He also thought it was the most accountable and innovative form of political organization, and that would have particular advantages in a globalized and information-based economy. But consistent with the market populism, he also recognized a role for the federal government in national standards and social policy, and more so than most observers, he thought the provinces should take the lead in designing these standards and in the broader socioeconomic union. And he spent a lot of time thinking about the ways in which provinces could try to institutionalize this approach. The relationship between market populism and federalism could be tense. Tom believed Canadian federalism ought to conform to the economic and social needs of Canadians, not the other way around. But he also realized Canadian federalism imposed important constraints. And I think as his career wore on, he began to see the constraints slightly differently, less as strict obstacles and more as legitimate expressions of some of the country's deepest compromises and values. So it's worth reflecting a little bit on the key features of this approach. Okay, we've heard it today. We know for starters that Tom was multidisciplinary. He was conversant with economists, political scientists, legal scholars, and others. He also drew on a variety of theoretical and normative frameworks, and he applied the approach to an enormous range of policy fields. His great gift, though, was being able to put it all together. He appreciated far more than most that economy, society, and federalism operated as a system, and that the system was comprised of subsystems, all of which interacted and contained their own internal complexities and dynamics. And it was these interactions, rather than the operation of any single policy or program, that determined whether the system was working for Canadians. This approach was evident in his most comprehensive works, of course, but it was also, you could also find it in just about anything he wrote. Nothing was studied in isolation. Equalization, for example, was studied in relation to the broader transfer system, and the broader transfer system in relation to the needs of Canadians and in an evolving economy, and the compatibility of that system and these needs with the system's political sustainability and sources of interprovincial solidarity. Tom, I think, was the first to really grapple with the political economy of intergovernmental transfers in a comprehensive way. And the analysis shed a lot of light on complexities and tensions that we had generally overlooked. And it's important, I think, to appreciate how difficult this was, the ability to talk across disciplines, the ability to link the normative, descriptive, and causal aspects of the analysis, the ability to link micro and macro and everything in between, the ability to see the big picture on the one hand, and then to be able to combine that with almost a wonkish attention to policy detail on the other, and to be able to do all that while managing to keep the plot. Now, you occasionally see economists and political scientists, I'm a political scientist, by the way, attempting this, trying to emulate this integrative approach, often in collaboration with one another. But if you look at those papers, it's often pretty easy to spot which section of the paper the political scientist wrote, which section of the paper the economist wrote, and it doesn't really, it often doesn't really feel like it's coming together. That wasn't a problem for Tom. He did all the economics and the political science himself. The challenge and the frustration, I think, for readers was that Tom wasn't really doing anything resembling conventional economics or political science at all. But that's the risk you'll take when you take on that integrative role. And as Keith and others have said today, I think Tom did that fearlessly. Okay, so for the relevance of Tom's work today, so I actually don't think everyone has to do economics or political economy like Tom. I think we need all sorts of people. We better need all sorts of people, or I'm out of a job. Doing all sorts of things. I even think there's a role, you know, for social scientists who want to lock themselves in their office, unplug from the policy world, and you know, and develop abstract models and explore their logics. That's how we came up with game theory. But none of these insights are going to matter unless we got people who can pull it together. And as Bob was just saying, we don't have nearly enough of those people. So I think we need a lot more of Tom. Now, I had originally planned to conclude, like some of the others today, and ask the question, you know, is the market populist vision or the Tom's decentralized vision of federalism compatible with today's realities, and talk about some of the policy challenges. Given some of the conversation that's taking place, I've decided I'm going to take a slightly different approach. It occurs to me Tom wrote during a period where it was, I don't want to suggest there was anything comfortable about the type of analysis Tom did. It was very unorthodox, but it was a comfortable time for a market populist. Throughout his career, market forces were either pervasive or strengthening, or there was a strong case earlier in his career to make those forces stronger. And it was also the case that it was easy to imagine, even if in practice it didn't necessarily work out, it was at least easy enough to imagine how you might try to reconcile economic efficiency with social policy through this human capital approach. But today, as has been said, the market forces are under threat. The state is resurgent, and it's going to become it has become very difficult, given all the upheaval and uncertainty, for policymakers to try to figure out how to place their bets. And I wonder, and this is partially an answer to response to your question, Keith. And I wonder if your question with respect to market populism. I wonder if Tom might even, you know, if he were writing in this context, if he might want to take a step back and ask a more general type of question, and that might be, how do you recalibrate policies and federal structures and processes to try to support workers in any context, right, including one in which markets may be in retreat. It would have been maybe a difficult possibility for him to confront, but I actually think he might have been flexible enough to consider it. But the main contribution in my mind actually isn't the market populism or the decentralist vision of federalism. I think it was his complex systems approach. I think it was his ability to present a tractable representation of the political economy and use that to try to anticipate and respond to the challenges ahead. As Jennifer, and this is the last thing I threw in at the last minute, to use that model to try to sort of make sense of everything around us and find purpose in the complexity and the uncertainty. I think that might be his more general and relevant contribution, and hopefully it'll be his most enduring. Okay, thank you.
And you're one shot, you gotta give it all you got.
And Olivier Jacques is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the School of Public Health at the Université de Montréal. He received his PhD from the Department of Political Science at McGill University and has been the Skelton Clark postdoctoral fellow at Queen's University.
Okay. Thank you. So today I want to focus on Tom's remark on fiscal federalism. I'm going to time myself because this is a topic I can talk about for hours. So I want to rely on a 2004 article that he wrote in Policy Options of the IRPP. When I read this article, I was amazed by how prescient this is, how relevant it still is today. This is 2004, and more than 20 years after, this is extremely relevant to explain the Federation. And I think he made many predictions that have been verified since then, and many assumptions that have been tested afterwards. The article is called, it's about what he calls hourglass federalism. Hourglass federalism means that Ottawa privileged a direct relationship with individuals and with cities, bypassing the provinces. Tom said that this is possible because of vertical fiscal imbalance. The invention of new federal programs for citizens and for cities is actually a proof of this vertical fiscal imbalance, because Ottawa, as a surplus to spend, can create new programs and use its superior fiscal position to create these new programs. And Tom traces back this vertical imbalance to the cuts to transfers that have been made in the 1995 budget. Transfers to provinces were cut by a third in the 1995 budget. So Ottawa was basically reduced his own deficit by transferring his deficit to the provinces. And interestingly, I was looking at whether or not Ottawa has been punished by these cutbacks. And no, actually the approval of the government of Ottawa went up because people were happy because the deficit was reduced. But then people were pissed against their provincial governments that were therefore, they had to make cuts in transfers, for instance, in hospitals or in healthcare. All provinces embarked on austerity journeys afterwards because of these cuts. And this creates perverse incentives between Ottawa and the province, perverse incentives that I will come back to a bit later. And Tom mentions in 2004 that it's a rare situation of fiscal surpluses at the provincial level and at the federal level at the same time. It lasts until the financial crisis of 2008. Ottawa is able to go back to surpluses in 2014. And now, despite a decade of deficit spending in Ottawa, if you actually look at the long-term fiscal situation of Ottawa, it's kind of fine. The net debt is trending down. Whereas for provinces, if you look at the long-term fiscal situation of provinces, the net debt is exploding, and there's going to be huge troubles in the decades coming. I think this has serious consequences for the Federation. So it's not just arcane fiscal federalism. You know, it's important in people's life. Because what it means is that provinces are incapable of giving to their citizens what they want, and therefore citizens demand more from governments, and liberal governments in Ottawa have been able to use their ample fiscal room to invest in areas of provincial jurisdiction. Paul Martin did it, Justin Trudeau did it. Recently with Daniel Bellin and Peter Grave, we wrote an article that basically does the bilan of the Justin Trudeau government, and we're showing that this is the biggest social policy expansion at the federal level probably in history that Justin Trudeau did. And this is possible in part by vertical imbalance. Cities also actually welcome this federal intrusion in provincial jurisdiction because they are cash-stripped. They are cash-stripped because the provinces are cash-stripped, so they just want the money. I understand their view. And Tom wrote an article on surplus recycling 10 years after, in 2014. And the argument is that Ottawa has no incentive to recycle these surpluses for the greater good of the Federation, that is to make sure that provinces can fund the services people need by increasing transfers to provinces. I actually contend that Ottawa, when Ottawa is a surplus, it has incentives to either invest directly in citizens in areas of provincial jurisdiction or to cut taxes. It will not increase transfers to the level demanded by provinces. Actually, Ottawa has strong electoral incentive to use its spending powers in areas of provincial jurisdiction. If you look at federal parties' programs, this is very clear. Both the NDP and the Liberals, they propose that, for instance, every Canadian is going to have access to a doctor. Well, this is great, but it's not really doable for Ottawa. You know, it's not how it works. So why won't Ottawa use its surpluses to increase transfers to provinces? I argue that this is because the relationship between Ottawa and provinces is plagued by what I call a principal-agent problem. Because Ottawa is the principal. It has the money. But Ottawa doesn't know what provinces are going to do with the money. And provinces do, as we say in French, sometimes n'importe quoi with the money. They basically, if you look at what happened with the last increase of transfers that Justin Trudeau did in 2023, all the provinces cut taxes with it. At least all the big provinces cut taxes with it. So they complain that they don't have enough money, they receive more money, they cut taxes, right? And therefore, Ottawa is thinking, well, okay, but if I give you more money for healthcare, I cannot really know what you're going to do with the money. And in fact, as we were discussing earlier with someone here, it's that the transfers are not really conditional. Ottawa cannot force provinces to invest the money in healthcare, actually. Cannot really do that. And actually, if Ottawa increases transfer, it may as well get blamed by the electorate. Why? Because it means higher deficit, more taxes at the federal level, spending cuts at the federal level in other areas. And who gets the credit? The provinces. So it's the reverse dynamic that I was mentioning earlier. So Ottawa has no incentive to increase transfers. Tom saw it, I think it's a more systematic problem than what he mentioned in his article. Ottawa is also incentivized to cut taxes with the surpluses. And by cutting taxes, technically you could solve vertical imbalance if provinces raise their own taxes. That's basically what Harper did. He cut 2 points of the GST, and some provinces raised taxes, but only provinces east of Ottawa River. The other ones did not. Therefore, it's not clear that it's really going to work as a strategy for solving vertical imbalance. Actually, Tom had a solution for this. He said that Ottawa should convert 2 GST points into revenue-based transfers to the provinces. So Ottawa basically saw this problem. He said that Ottawa will spend its fiscal room to maneuver either by creating new programs or by cutting taxes, but it's not going to solve vertical imbalance with its fiscal room to maneuver. Tom suggested another solution. So perhaps the solution would be that provinces would delegate their powers to Ottawa. That's a solution that is possible. And Tom mentioned that it could be the case for pharmacare, for instance. And I like, though, that Tom said that could be interesting because for Quebec, because Tom always suggested that there could be some form of asymmetrical relationship with Quebec. And I like also that he said that we cannot really say that Quebec is opting out of a program. He wrote, if a province operates a program that falls within its constitutional jurisdiction, it cannot be said to be opting out of that program, actually. You cannot opt out when Ottawa uses its spending power. It's rather that the rest of Canada opted in or forfeited their constitutional powers to Ottawa. And so why should we care about all this? The fact that the money is in Ottawa, that transfers to healthcare aren't sufficient to cover the growing cost of healthcare, means that's what Tom said. He said that what's going to happen is that, well, provinces are going to spend all their money in healthcare, and there's not going to be any fiscal room left to invest in, for instance, education. And he said it was very important to invest in education for Canada's position in the knowledge economy. And Tom mentioned that this is because provinces are not going to be able to cut back on healthcare because healthcare is backed by powerful constituencies. And more than that, I would argue that it's because healthcare is so popular that provinces cannot cut easily healthcare. And actually what happened, I think it's a bit different than what Tom suggested. At the time of writing, Tom actually thought that provincial healthcare spending would crowd out the rest of spending by provinces. It did, but I think less than he expected, because provinces were actually able to impose cost controls on healthcare. But the results are dire as well. I mean, provinces were able to impose cost control. Healthcare did not crowd that much the rest of spending. But now citizens are very unsatisfied with healthcare in Canada. Satisfaction with healthcare has reached its lowest level since we were recording public opinion on the issue. And I think we have a problem with our healthcare system in the country. And it starts with fiscal federalism. So that's why it's so important to care about these issues. You know, it's important in people's lives. It's not just arcane issues of fiscal federalism. So that's why I think Tom's contribution is still relevant today. Again, why should we care? Well, as a Quebecer, the nation is seen to be at the provincial level. So if provinces don't have autonomy, well, the nation doesn't have autonomy. As a Canadian, I think that the principle of subsidiarity, that it was so dear to Tom, involves that we want decisions to be made closer to the people. And also, I think that preferences between provinces, between regions in this country are too distinct for them to be made only in Ottawa. And I'm not sure that Ottawa knows best than provinces, and I'm pretty sure that Tom would agree with this. And also, I would say that this vertical imbalance also involves not enough incentives to give more money to cities, which is an issue in a world where our economy depends on healthy and economically vibrant large cities. Thank you very much.
I'm
Yeah, and I think the great thing that Tom did was to expand the concept of federalism to include indigenous people, which is really the as in the much regretted Charlottetown Accord, which I've spent a full 2 years of my life working on. It was the one government initiative of all of two levels of government to accept the fact that there was, in addition to the municipalities, a fourth level of government, which another level of government, which was indigenous government. And I think that was a huge breakthrough. Yeah, I really think the study of the details of federalism is what actually leads you to understand the philosophy behind it. It's not a, federalism in Canada is not a theoretical issue. It's an intensely practical issue, which in turn creates our value structures, the extent to which we really learn how to share and understand and appreciate the diversity of the country, the regional nature of the country, and extraordinary richness of the tapestry of Canada. And really, think of Canada as being a tapestry, federalism is really the study of the Canadian tapestry, as well as the tapestry of other countries. So Tom taught us a lot about that.
Wonderful way to wrap up. Thank you very much to Olivier, Kyle, and Bob.
So when I say hip, you say hop. Hip, hip. And when I say don't, you say stop. Don't, don't.
My name is Anthony Pasqua. I also go by Big Tones. I'm a hip-hop artist and artist mentor from Saskatoon out in Saskatchewan, and I'm coming from Pasqua First Nations down in Treaty 4 territory. I realized I was a good writer further down the line in my life, but it was in high school when it kind of got implanted in my mind, and one of my high school teachers was telling me that I was a really great writer, and so it was kind of imprinted in the back of my head, but it wasn't until later in life when I kind of started making music and kind of returned back to school that I realized I was really gifted with writing. When my teacher told me about that, that was something that always sat in the back of my mind, and it was something that kind of like, it really helped me get through a lot of times when you're feeling down on yourself. And I don't know if she knows, but it always kind of stuck with me forever throughout the rest of my life.
Because when the fog lifts, the light shine, even in the nighttime. If ever feeling low, I'll grab my pen and then I'll write rhymes. I cried many tears.
I was inspired to begin writing back in 2019 when my cookman passed away, and I went into a pretty deep depression, a lot of anxiety, and so I started going to therapy. And that was something that was helping me kind of uncover who I was on the inside. And from there, I realized that like kind of writing about myself and learning about myself was super important. I was writing about like my depression and my anxiety a lot first before I started writing about like broader things, but it was more introspective at first, and it really helped me uncover like who I am as a person. The song that I made here at the Reverie Residency is called Shine, and it's a song that kind of refers to the parallel of life being divine, so all of like the ancestors that are around us kind of shining down on us and guiding us throughout life. That's essentially what the song is about. It's very introspective to myself and also broad for the world to also connect with.
Parallel to life is place that we don't know. Tears drop to the pain through the window. Wipe the fog, see the sunshine and flowers. Minute after minute, hour after hour. The dark sits, but we gotta let that light shine. Guaranteed to crash and burn within this lifetime. With no insurance, resets can feel impossible. But once you
bounce back,
you unstoppable. Goosebumps and that deja vu. Let the ancestors speak, or they got you. Feel complete with a soul full of medicine. Power from above, but we just gotta let it in. I'm paying homage here to Tracy Victoria, Donna Joyce McNabb, the sweet grass warrior. There's no coincidence in places that I've been, and I can really feel the power of the queen. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is a road that's divine. Let that light shine, let it shine. You know I love you, you always on my mind. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is a road that's divine. Let that light shine, let it shine. You know I love you, you always on my mind. They say the city never sleeps, footsteps like the beat. Hear the damn sing the song, or the preacher you preach. Summer nights, but it's cold on the block. Voices in their head and they begging them to stop. A single mother, baby, pays you with his brother. Cause daddy got lost and he's found undercover. The child yearns for the love from his pops. Pain never lasted, addicted to the block. It's penny days that pays the strike, no one's spoken. Indebted to the path in this life that we chosen. No credit here, you're told to pay with your life. And if you pay it for it once, you can pay for it twice. Come check the moral of this story I've been telling. The people on the ground really angels from heaven. Sometimes the darkness lights fill the sky. So don't be scared, let that light shine. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is a road that's divine. Let that light shine, let it shine. You know I love you, you always on my mind. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is a road.
Invite all the homies up for the end of here. Put your hands up like this.
You know I love you, you always on my mind. When I shine, you shine, shine. When you shine, I shine, shine. When we shine, they shine, shine. When they shine, we shine, shine. When I shine, you shine, shine. When you shine, I shine, shine. When we shine, they shine, shine. When they shine, we shine. Life is places that we don't know. Tears drop to the pain through the window. Wipe the fog, see the sunshine and flowers. Minute after minute, hour after hour. The darkness sits, but we gotta let that light shine. Guaranteed to crash and burn within this lifetime. With no insurance, resets can feel impossible. But once you
bounce back,
you unstoppable. Goosebumps and that deja vu. Let the ancestors speak while they guide you. Feel complete with a soul full of medicine. Power from above, but we just gotta let it in. I'm paying homage here to Tracy Victoria, Donna Joyce McNabb, the sweet grass warrior. There's no coincidence in places that I've been, and I can really feel the power of the queen. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is the road that's divine. Let that light shine, let it shine. You know I love you. You see the city never sleeps, footsteps like a beat. Hear the damn sing the song while the preacher he preach. Summer nights, but it's cold on the block. Voices in their head and they begging them to stop. A single mother raising babies with a brother. Cause daddy got lost, then he's found undercover. The child yearns for the love from his pops. Pain never lasted, addicted to the block. It's every day the price is paid, going smoking. Indebted to the path in this life that we've chosen. No credit here, told to pay with your life. And if you pay it for it once, you can pay for it twice. Come check the moral of the story I've been telling. The people on the ground, really angels from heaven. Sometimes the lost darkness fills the sky. So don't be scared, let that light shine. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is the road that's divine. Let that light shine, let it shine. You know I love you, you always on my mind. Let that light shine, let it shine. Parallel to life is the road that's divine. Let that light shine, let it shine. You know I love you, you always on my mind.
When I shine, you shine, shine. When you shine, I shine, shine. When we shine, they shine, shine. When they shine, we shine, shine. When I shine, you shine, shine. When you shine, I shine, shine. When we shine, they shine, shine. When they shine, we shine.
My name is Genevieve, and I'll be hosting Peace, Love, and Jenny on CFRC 101.9 FM on Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. We'll be exploring everything from pop and soul to funk, jazz, and even a touch of hip-hop. Music that spans decades but all connects through good vibes, peace and love, and of course, a little bit of me, Jenny. See you there.
Roll the dice on Saturday nights at 11 p.m. with CFRC's Radio Roulette. Every week we get a new randomly generated playlist courtesy of the Online Digital Media Library. We let fate decide and the host must abide. So I hope you'll join me on this journey through genres, time, and taste each and every single Saturday at 11 p.m.